Is the love affair with cars really over? Not judging by August new car sales. And then we're going to take a viewpoint from Toyota of what it's all about.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by the 2013 Hyundai Elantra. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 209 for September 6th of 2013. Toyota-thon with Bob Carter. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Hey, John.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Excellent.
Good week?
Yeah, good week.
Yeah, good week for me, too.
Good issue about extremists. And
yeah, we're going to get into that, but we got to introduce our other partner here in crime, Bryce Hoffman.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you.
Great to
always
be here.
Always a pleasure.
Have you here. So. But yeah, we got to get to what you were writing about in your website this week. Is the love affair with cars really over? And so what? Somebody came out with a survey or something?
Yeah, well, the anti-car intelligentsia is really in certain touchy-feely enclaves of the country. And every once in a while, they rear their ugly heads and, you know, say we're all going to be riding around in a 21st century version of rickshaws with connectivity, and that we'll all be good, and it'll all be bunny rabbits and rainbows, and totally benign, and everything will be good, and the cars is going to go away. And every time they do that, it's just like they make bigger fools of themselves each time.
So yeah.
I laid them out pretty good.
Yes, you did. I don't think there's any question that people are not as into cars as when we were growing up. That there's no question about it. And a younger generation is not as interested in cars overall, and it's a declining rate. But that doesn't mean that the interest in automobiles or even the love affair with cars has gone away.
Well,
not yet.
Well, Sean McElhenney had the best thing, best quote. He said, really comes down to the economy. As soon as people, our guest is going to come up, and Toyota has spent a lot of time, and all the manufacturers have, time, money, research, big data, we got to get young people buying our cars. Well, young people like cars, they just can't afford them.
Right.
And Sean McElhenney said, well, it's funny, but when people get a job and it's 25 miles down the road, they want to go get a car. And so I think much of it is economy-driven. We're in a different world. We've got, kids aspire to the latest handheld device, the latest iMac, latest iPhone, the Galaxy S4, whatever. That's all true. And things change. But I think the fundamental freedom of mobility thing is never going to go away.
That's right.
And certainly not as long as we have a country that has virtually no public transportation. People are ultimately going to want to get from point A.
But it's not just this country either. The point is, in countries where you have exceptionally good public transportation, like Europe, which is an economic basket case right now, right? But not in England. The UK is going gangbusters, even though you've got pretty good public transportation there. Car sales are on, the resurgence in Japan again. It's got a great public transportation system. So does China, by the way. But people want that freedom of mobility to go where they want to go, when they want to go, with whom they want to go, at the temperature they want, with the music they want, et cetera, et cetera.
And everyone arrives at it at different points in their lives. I mean, when we were growing up, I was driving at 14, unbeknownst to my parents and
oh, you were a late starter, huh?
Yeah.
I was lying to my parents at 13.
Yeah,
I
took the car out.
12 on my uncle's farm.
No kidding. Yeah, all right, Bryce.
My oldest sister busted me one night. She was at the Fisher Theater, I thought, till late. And I pull in just as she's getting out of her car in the garage. And that was a little awkward. But, everyone arrives at it differently. And I think nowadays, since you know, all the soccer moms have done a wonderful job shuttling their kids around until they're 30.
Well, why do you need to buy a new car if you're living at home anyway, so you can still drive your parents' car?
So, and, you know, they've got, you know, in our day, you went and tried to meet girls, you know, you go to the drive, whatever you did. You were in your car, they were in their cars. Now it's, you know, all on the devices. But eventually, something happens where it's the light bulb goes on. I need a car. Not only do I need a car, I want a car. I need to
and
do
as long things. As I want a car, I want to fill in the blank.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something that will attract you to buy what you want. Some people will know. They'll just go by price, and I just need a set of wheels. But they'll still pick something, you know? Yeah. They're still making a choice, even when they want the most basic transportation.
Well, you know, we all, ever since we got involved with this industry, I'm sure have had the same experience, which is that you tell somebody anywhere in the world that you were involved in the auto industry, and they will talk your ear off.
That's right.
And that just speaks to the passion of this. I mean, I was in the rainforest in Brazil and told a guy that I covered the auto industry, and I listened for the next 45 minutes to him going over what his favorite cars were and how great this car was and how horrible that car was. And, I mean, it's like, you know, any place in the world, that's the case because the passion is there. But I do think that things are changing.
Yeah. No. In fact, my line has always been, even when you run into those people who hate cars, they love to tell you how much they
exactly.
hate them.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, no, we are changed. I mean, it's not things aren't changing. We're changed and down the road. But, you know, you can't categorically dismiss the automobile.
No, you can't because, look, I'll go back to when I was in high school, which was, you know, probably one of the peaks of car culture in America.
I was.
It feels like it sometimes. No, but I mean, you know, I was a hardcore enthusiast, and I had a few friends who were, but the vast majority of kids at the school were not hardcore enthusiasts. Mm-hmm. So to say that, you know, oh, we've lost this whole car culture thing is crazy.
I don't believe it.
There is, you know, here's the thing, and I agree in general, but there, I will make this point. I remember a couple years ago I was working on a story about this, and I was talking to GM, and they were sharing with me a bunch of their demographic research data they'd done, and some of the stuff, it curled my hair. Over half of teenagers in the survey that they showed me said that their favorite place to be is their bedroom. I mean, that was where we went when we were in trouble, and then we tried to sneak out. They said that the preferred way to interact with their friends is online, not in person, not even on the phone. And you do have this cultural shift that's happening where people are spending so much time in front of the computer screen, kids, that they don't see the same value that we did. I mean, you know, I, you know, when I was a teenager in the 1980s, all of my friends, I mean, the day you turned 15 and a half in California, you could get your permit. I mean, I was standing outside the DMV waiting for it to open. And I mean, you know, driving home that afternoon, and I don't think I ever, you know, didn't.
Oh, yeah, look, we all took driver's ed when we were 15. So yeah. The day we turned 16, we could get our license.
And they don't even have that anymore.
Yeah, well, now the stories are, you know, you're 20, you really need to get a license. You know, you're going to have to get a job somewhere. And you know, that's more of the stories you hear that, you know, they've been shuttled around, and so they just, I never thought I'd need to get a license. Yeah, you're going to need to get a license.
And part of it is the urbanization trend, too, because, you know, I was shocked. California, I grew up in California, which is a very car-centric, you know, culture, obviously. I moved to New York to do my internship after college, and I was stunned. None of my editors at the magazine I worked at had a car except one, and she didn't know how to drive. She had a 1960s convertible that she had people drive her in when she felt like, you know, experiencing a car. And the whole concept of not knowing how to drive when you were 40 years old and not wanting to was so foreign to me. But as more people move to cities, I think you're going to see more of
it. It's an increasing trend.
Yeah.
And then, you know, right around the corner is this autonomous technology stuff where you're going to have this machine that you'll just tell it what to do, and you're not going to have to want to control it. Maybe you will want to.
Maybe you want to as it careens into the car in front of you. But
it's interesting, you know, when I lived in Manhattan, most everyone I knew, if they had a car, it was underused or they were hardcore enthusiasts. And then I came to realize that Manhattan and the surrounding areas have some of the hardest core car people there.
Oh, yeah,
are.
No question.
Because you have to be.
If you
want to have an enthusiast car of any kind, and you're in Manhattan or you're around and you're dry. I mean, those people are hardcore because you really have to want it bad.
You have to put up with a lot
yeah.
for your passion.
So I have utmost respect for them when mm-hmm. I see them. I mean, a couple of years ago, I was at the New York Auto Show and I saw this guy driving down Park Avenue in a 59 baby blue Cadillac convertible, and it was just like, yeah, that's cool. It was good. Great imagery.
And, and getting back to what's happened this week, we got the August car sales. The industry's rocking right now. I mean, in many cases, they can't even keep up with demand. So this whole notion that people don't care about cars or don't want them anymore, the facts don't quite jive with that.
Though some of that's replacement. I mean, the average age is going up. It's over... gone up another 6 months, I think, in the past 6 months, and easy credit is kind of jarring some of these people out of their old clunkers and into new cars. But I think you're right. I think that there's still it shows you that if even with jobless rate, not coming down significantly, you still see this big a jump in sales. You got to see that a lot of people are just trying to get into a new car as soon as they can.
Right. I mean, and, we'll have Bob Carter on here in a little bit, too, and from Toyota, we'll talk more about that with him. But, I mean, it looks like it's going to keep on growing. I mean, it doesn't look like we've plateaued here at all.
And the industry is, I think, they've learned their lessons for the most part on the other roller coaster. Dips.
Well, that's what happens when you get rid of all these legacy costs, where, as I pointed out, it was cheaper not to make a car than to make
right.
one.
Yeah. Well, and the lesson is, I remember that one of the past presidents or CEOs of Mazda once said to me, you want to have enough capacity to build one less car than you can sell. And people have overcorrected now. The other way, you got Subaru now, which doesn't have cars to sell. I mean, which has, 12-day supply, 14-day supply, 16-day supplies of cars. But is still reluctant to pull the trigger on building a new
factory. Well, they should be careful. Subaru is, I think they're astonishing. And, they keep doing better and better and better. But, I'm not a big fan of their styling at all. I think their interiors look cheap. I think their connectivity is some of the worst in the business. They need to address some issues before they talk about really growing big.
And kudos to their CEO who... a few weeks ago said, everyone's pushing for more capacity. And he was like, we need to make sure we're Subaru. But you're right, John. I mean, the design isn't something, is an oxymoron that's applied to Subaru. I mean, and, for the most part, their buyers are fine with it. But, they at least have to get into the end of the 20th century before the 21st century is gone.
I actually went into one of their cars at the show last year with one of their product people, and I said, I had a Subaru, a late 80s Subaru, and I said, I swear to you that's the same turn signal that was in the indicator, lever that was in my Subaru, and he said, yeah, actually it is. We're a niche brand, we can't...
And I understand those sorts of things.
Yeah.
But, that doesn't explain cheap-looking interiors, stodgy styling.
Yeah.
As somebody once said a long time ago, the cost between stamping out a beautiful fender and an ugly one is the same.
But the design cost, though, that's the thing. If you're a small company and don't have the staff,
Oh, no, I don't buy that for a second. Yeah. There's plenty of people to hire, and if your people can't design, if they can't draw good cars, you got the wrong people.
Look at what Kia did.
But I think Subaru's got a real chance to really move upscale, at least in certain models. I think they could get a lot more pricing than what they're doing. I mean, look, the kind of buyer who bought Saabs, who's now maybe buying Volvos, except Volvo's cratering right now.
Yeah.
They need new models. I think there's some area there that if Subaru played its cards right, it could go after those customers.
Well, the problem with Volvo is that once Geely got a hold of it, they took Peter Horbury and shanghaied him to Shanghai.
But he's gone now.
Yeah.
He's gone. I mean,
did he do that?
No. Yeah, what did they call that thing? It was the Volvo concept. Ben, did we get that picture of the Volvo concept?
That's a...
it's pretty good looking car.
Yeah, it's pretty handsome.
But I was, it's this coupe that they're going to be showing. And,
that is nice.
It's got real hard edges to it, you know, but it's, so it's almost boxy, but very sleek at the same time. So, to me, that's a very good look. Almost a little too Maserati in the grill, though, the way that sort of escalped in.
How can you be too Maserati? That's like being too sexy.
Well, I know, but one should not copy design,
that's
right?
Who drew the car?
The new designer at Volvo, and I wasn't even aware that Horbury was gone until this car popped up, and I don't know, Ben, maybe the chat room can cough up the answer of who's the head of design at Volvo now.
Interesting.
So what else do we want to talk about?
Well, the other Frankfurt stuff, man, everybody, I'm not sure why I'm going to Germany next week because I've seen everything that's going to be out.
The Audi Quattro thing is...
It's cool, but it's like... I think it's a little too conservative, styling-wise, actually.
But it's pretty... consistent with Audi, though. I had to laugh at the release. I said, "Oh yes, and there's plenty of room in the back for two."
It's the side view. I know it's an homage to the sport coupe of the '80s. I get that, but
I like how they said, "Well, there's plenty of room for two people in the back." Right? Why even bother saying stuff like that? You know, the mechanicals and the specs on it all sound impressive, you know, but isn't it going to be like 200-some thousand or more?
Something like
It's going to be more than the most expensive R8.
Really? No, it'll be crazy.
Oh, that's true.
It'll be crazy stupid. Let's see, what else? Oh, and Jag has that CX-17.
Oh, the crossover.
Right. All they've put out is the silhouette. So there's a question. Should Jag be doing a crossover? That's what we pose to our viewers.
Well, you know, after Porsche did it, all bets were off.
I know, but Jag's got Land Rover.
Exactly.
Right?
That's the thing. Aren't they eating lunch?
I was getting to that. Porsche did it. I mean, it sort of broke the mold. But why would Jaguar do this when, you know, they have, like, one of the ultimate SUVs in their stable. I don't understand it, I think. And, you know, for the same reason I didn't like the idea of the Cayenne, I don't think a Jaguar crossover, it just doesn't work for me. It just doesn't. I don't think they need to do it, especially in their vehicle family. They have such great, you know.
I don't know, Peter, because, you know, I remember back to when Lincoln was agonizing over what they then called the town truck. You know, they had the town car, they came out with the town truck, that became the Expedition.
Yeah.
And they, not the Expedition, the...
MKT.
No. Not MKT.
I know what you're talking about, that pickup truck.
The Mark...
Navigator.
Oh, the Navigator.
Wasn't the Navigator? It was the Lincoln Navigator,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the code name inside, actually informally,
well,
was
they
the
did
town
the,
truck.
They did the Blackwood first.
Yeah, that was that.
That was... There's an instant collector's item.
I'll tell you, when I started covering Ford, that was one of the first cars that I got, and I laughed my head off when they dropped it off my driveway. But I'll tell you something, it was a very comfortable car, very comfortable truck.
Yeah. But anyway,
embarrassing to drive.
Lincoln agonized, should they do the town truck? And they went and headed and did it, and pow, sales just took off. And that's about the time where Cadillac went, oh, we're never going to do that. And a year later, they caved to the dealers, and they took a Suburban, whatever, and they
And that's where all the profitability was.
And that's where it all is. And then Porsche with the Cayenne, I'll bet you Jag does a crossover. I'll bet it's hugely successful.
Oh, well,
for them.
They're not showing a concept to not do it. They're doing it. It's well down the road.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Well, you know, Peter, you said you don't see the point of the Cayenne, but you're not a Chinese Communist Party official. So,
yeah.
You know.
Not yet.
Let me just say the first Cayenne, you know, was a big disappointment for a lot of reasons. The second Cayenne, someone inside Porsche told me that was the first Cayenne that we actually went out of her way to...
Meant to do?
Yeah, meant to do. They took 1,000 pounds out of it. They, you know, dynamically, it was a whole lot better. And now I'm hearing that the Macan is dynamically a superstar. Hmm. Like, they've found some things doing the Macan that there's going to, you know, really be impressive. So, I don't know. All bets are off. It's about branding and how strong is the brand. Porsche is able to so far, make it all work. Yeah. So if Jaguar does, I guess more power to them, but...
But you're not going to be happy with it anyway.
Well, I'm not the market for it. So.
But isn't it even more surprising, though, how much good stuff has come out of Jaguar since Todd bought it? I mean, I think a lot of people thought that...
Sure, because now it's totally focused. It's its own company. You don't have to kowtow to what the corporation of the group thinks should be done.
But I will say, as nice as the F-Type is, it's just something about it. It doesn't make me want to race down and get one or order one. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's okay, but it could also be a front-engine, rear-drive sports car for a number of car companies. It doesn't scream Jaguar to me. Not that it's not a competent car, a fun car, and all that, but it doesn't necessarily scream Jaguar at me, and I don't know why that is. Maybe I'll come around, but...
To me, it does look like a Jag. The only thing I'd say is these days, the problem with two-seat sports cars is, man, they carry so much mass. All this structural stuff for crash safety, which I understand. Yeah. I'm not complaining. But I'm just saying, they're porky cars.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's a heavy car for what you're getting.
Hey, let's take a quick commercial break. Let's get Bob Carter from Toyota on and see what he thinks is going on in this crazy automotive industry. Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone Firestone.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. We took the power of a 9-year-old V8 and gave it the impressive handling of Firestone's destination tire. Now, moms agree, every milk run feels like a victory lap. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Whether it's on television, online, or through social media, AutoLine knows how to effectively get your marketing message to the people you want to reach. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
So Bob Carter from Toyota, thanks so much for coming on AutoLine After Hours with us.
Well, thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
And, you know, we're doing the show just as we've gotten the sales figures from August. And, wow, you guys were number two in the U.S. market, number two only to General Motors. The Toyota Camry actually outsold the Chevrolet Silverado. Lexus went back to being the best-selling luxury brand in the American market. I mean, I'm sure you can just kick your heels back up on your desk and relax now, right?
Well, I don't know if that's ever a case, but, John, I will tell you, we're so pleased with August that if I'm dreaming, please don't wake me up. It was a really good month, all month. It started off well, and then Labor Day weekend was spectacular for Toyota, spectacular for the industry. I think there's a number of things to drive in that.
Wait a minute now, because you said an important thing, Labor Day weekend. So some of the sales in September fell into August, right?
Yeah, because the industry has an agreement that if the last day of the month falls on a weekend, then the industry closes on the first business day. And the first business day was Tuesday because of the national holiday. So it was a long month. It was 28 business days, 5 weekends. So, you know, it was longer than typical. But it's still, I don't want to take anything away. Fundamentally,
even on a daily selling rate basis, the market was up strong.
Well, it was, when you look at the total volume, part of that was a longer month. But on a daily rate, consumers were out shopping last month. There's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm. So, Bob, didn't Toyota invent the Toyota-thon? I mean, didn't the Toyota-thon basically become like a fixture for Toyota? When was that?
I think it was 32, maybe 33 years ago.
Because as I recall, that pretty much changed everything when you guys started doing that, because nobody else was doing it.
Right.
Now you have, of course, everyone does something like it.
Yeah.
But it was a game changer, wasn't it, for this business?
Yeah, actually, Toyota-thon, and it's still today, that's our
year. Explain that a bit in case any viewers don't know what we mean by this.
So we were really the first, or Toyota was the first, to run a national sale.
Year-end sale, right?
Year-end sale. And the first one that we did was Toyota-thon 32, 33 years ago. And really what it was designed to do at the time, as you remember back then, there was an adage in the car business is you can't fight Santa Claus. So everybody just sort of avoided December. It was just hunker down, we'll get through this, and we'll get back to selling cars in January.
Right.
So it was an effort of, well, let's see. And it really came from our dealers. Let's see what we can do. Let's come out. Let's promote. Let's push and see how we can how much business we can generate in the month of December. Month of December for us, and I think mostly for the industry, it's not the biggest month. That certainly lies in August and May, two traditionally high months. But December has turned into be a very good month for the industry. And then eventually we said, well, it worked in December. Let's do a national sales event for us in the month of May and a month of August. So you traditionally see us three times a year, working very close with the dealers to do those events.
So when did the luxury market in the U.S., you know, has a real big thing from about Thanksgiving to the end of the year? Now, did you guys start that or with Lexus, or was that another manufacturer?
Well, that was actually came off of the success we had with Toyota-thon.
So you thought
we thought, well, let's try it on the luxury business. So in Lexus, we started back in the very early 90s, and it became December to Remember with the big red bows.
The holiday.
As if they were Christmas presents, right?
Right. 25 years later, we're still doing it. It's very successful.
Well, yeah, all the luxury manufacturers are doing.
Right.
I mean, it's a huge deal. Cottage industry in unto itself, basically, right?
Yeah,
it's changed the luxury business too. A lot of people wait till December to get their luxury and near luxury and pseudo luxury cars.
Do cars become big Christmas presents, or is it somebody just rewarding themselves, or why does this work?
Well, a little bit of both. I mean, there's. And it's still maybe a little bit of legacy back from the days where sales tax in many states was deductible. So there was a segment of the consumer that got their year-end bonus. You know, I got to buy a car before January 1st so I can write off the sales tax. Well, those days are long gone, but you still have that cycle of consumers of, you know, some like to purchase in the spring, some in the summer, some in the winter. So those 3 months have really developed to be big months for the industry. But, John, I think there's something that's really fundamental going on. We, you know, I've always broken it down, what's important to the car industry in terms of the market. And really overly simplified, it's three things. It's cars, it's credit, and it's confidence. And if you can line those three things up, the industry's going to have a pretty good month. So on cars, I mean, there's all kinds of new cars. The industry, the introductions, I can imagine from your side, because my side, it's tough to keep up with all the new models coming to the market. Credit's accessible. And yes, you know, short-term rates may creep up a little bit. You know, we expect it. But even under all scenarios, it's still going to remain at record low rates.
What I've heard
rates.
Is maybe the interest rates would raise monthly payments $5 to $10 a month.
Right. You know, not going to be a fundamental shift in the car business. But really what I think is taking place in the month of August, consumer confidence. If you take a look at the confidence index that comes out of the government, I think that's a really good predictor of what's going on. People are feeling better. They're feeling better about their job. They're feeling better about their income. Their houses are worth more, or perhaps they're, you know.
But is the public delusional? I mean, here we are on the verge of a war in Syria. You know, there's going to be a financial shutdown because the Democrats and Republicans can't even agree to raise the debt limit or do something about it. So is the public just whistling past the grave here?
Hope springs eternal, John.
Yeah, perhaps. But, you know, the average car in the U.S. now is 11.4 years old. You know, people delayed. And automobile purchases are still emotional. It's still a personal reward. And, you know, many consumers have delayed their purchase for economic or personal reasons. And now, you know, confidence, things are feeling better. I'm feeling better. I think we're all feeling better about where things are going. And people are out shopping. They've waited a long time. So It's not our opinion that this is a short-term anomaly. We, you know, certainly the industry is not going to experience 10% year-over-year growth like we just experienced. It'll be much more moderate. But we really see a robust industry in the years ahead, and we're feeling good about it.
And yet, though, just to John's point, we were talking earlier today at the APA thing, and you mentioned that the real concern that you do have, if you have one right now, about the future is the situation in the Middle East and how that could.
Right. Well, that's the uncontrollables and unknowns. You know, if you subscribe to, you know, consumer confidence is important for the job, you know, the global economy and what that could perhaps affect fuel prices and worst case, you know, wars. And so, you know, that may suppress the what's going on in the mind of consumers and may bring that confidence down. But those things are very unpredictable. We think the fundamentals is there that perhaps not 16.1 million months like we had last month, but it's going to be very good, particularly when you compare where we were just 3 years ago.
Yeah, that's the amazing part. So at the Center for Automotive Research is a big conference in Traverse City, the management briefing seminars that you spoke at. Some of the economists there were talking about 17 million units in the next 3 years or so.
Yeah.
What do you think? How does Toyota see it?
Well, first of all, to have independent economists talk about, I think they actually talked about flirting with 17 million by 2018. We're not necessarily there. I mean, I'm encouraged to hear that because we're all getting the crystal ball out. But we think that the industry will come in this year at a 15.5. It's acting maybe a little bit higher, progressing to an annualized 16 million. And then I hate using the word plateau because that sort of indicates that the party's over. Well, the party's not over. But we'll be in that 16 million range, and then it'll go up a little bit and down a little bit, but at a very, very healthy rate. So, you know, we see more, I guess I would call it stabilization, not plateauing, but a good solid 3 years in front of us.
Wow, that's great.
Did I actually hear the word fierce be attached to the Corolla in the press release? Really?
Perhaps.
Wow. I mean, it's better looking, but fierce, I don't know if I'd go that far.
Yeah, we're really excited about that product. Just to recap, we launched two cars this year, our new Avalon and new RAV, both performing real well, but now being, let's call ourselves Labor Day weekend, we just shipped our first Corollas to the dealers Friday before Labor Day. That car's just hitting the market, and then we're just also shipping a new Tundra. We have a new 4Runner, and then very late in the year, we have the new Highlander. So we have a lot of new product coming, and that product is really what drives the sale. The Corolla, we intentionally went to two different directions. First of all, what we didn't change. You know, that Corolla was all 40 million of them that we sold globally. But people bought them predominantly on perception of quality. That's what built our reputation. Good value, great MPG. Well, that's not changing. But we wanted to get the styling a little bit more emotional. So we made the LE, great-looking car. We'll appeal to the current buyer that, you know, that maybe a baby boomer generation that been buying Corollas and on their second or third or fourth one. But then we made the S, and we made it much more sporty to appeal to the boomer generation. So fierce, aggressive, emotional, you fill in the adjectives, but I love the look of the car.
I want to ask you about a move that I think really is fierce. Are you guys really going to sell a hydrogen car in the United States in 2015?
Yes, we are, or perhaps earlier.
But you're going to sell it, but Honda's already done it. And, you know, yeah, you're going to have cars and there's going to be customers.
Honda leased
them. This is like, you know, a volume of what, 10?
No,
that would
no,
be a big number,
no. The
right?
The volume's undetermined, but much more intense. But I'll put it in perspective. We're going to show the car first time at the Tokyo Motor Show. I've had no opportunity to see it, driven it. It's a wonderful car. The restrictor on hydrogen short term is infrastructure. And so there is an infrastructure currently, as we speak, being built in Southern California and in the San Francisco Bay Area. I just coincidentally, and I was surprised, we expect confirmed about 38 hydrogen retail hydrogen stations in Southern California by 2015. And it's sort of a soft launch date. The car's ready to go. It's just depending on the infrastructure. But the gas station I go to, I was shocked. I had no idea. They were doing some construction, and I looked, and they were actually putting in a hydrogen pump there. So that infrastructure is starting to come. But it is going to be very localized into some communities. Southern California, Northern California be the first. To have a more national distribution, time will tell.
Because I'm sure these stations that are going in right now, it's probably all government money paying for it.
Government, or there is some private investment. We joined up and actually built one in cooperatively with Shell Oil, which essentially the deal was we bought the property, and then Shell Oil, that had a massive natural gas line coming through the property, they built the fueling station themselves. So it will take some time. It's a really interesting car. It drives like any car drives. It drives very much like an EV, but then there's just drops of pure water coming out the tailpipe. So it's
I've driven a number of fuel cell cars. They're really good, but it's like you say, where do you get the hydrogen? And remember, hydrogen's got to be manufactured. You can't drill a hole in the ground and have it come bubbling up. So you got to manufacture it, and that takes energy. So what energy are you going to use? You know, there's a whole bunch of issues to be resolved, even though I understand every advanced R&D automotive person I've ever talked to has said hydrogen's the answer.
Well, what I think is interesting is there was like a period at which that waned. You know, GM, you remember, several years ago made the big high-profile announcement that they were going to invest $1 billion in developing.
Pre-bankruptcy.
Yeah, pre-bankruptcy.
That changed a lot.
They rolled that sled out at the auto show and stuff. And then
they did the sequel.
Yeah.
But they also did like 100 of, what were they, not Traverses, Equinoxes.
Yeah.
I drove one of those things, and, you know, they had a big program. Larry Burns, who ran their R&D, and he's still, you know, a hydrogen advocate. You know, Honda's big on it. Hyundai's building them. Mercedes is all into it. Ford's doing the same. I mean, everybody I talk to goes, hydrogen's the answer. Yeah. But I'm still skeptical that it's going to happen very quickly.
So I think the most transparent answer is nobody really knows. There's certainly advancements that can take place through just internal combustion engine. They can get smaller with more power, and weight reduction's a big part of that. We're doing that. There's a market for diesel. There's certainly we're leading with hybrid. There is, and there's a misnomer that we're giving up on EV. That is not the case. Battery technology needs to advance further than it is today. But there's a role for EV. There's a role for hydrogen. So our strategy, and we're fortunate enough with the success of the customers providing with the volume, we're developing all of these. We call it internally the portfolio of alternative fuel. And then ultimately the customer is going to decide, is it hydrogen, is it EV, is it continuation of ICE? I think it's going to be all of the above.
Hmm. But it's that darn internal combustion engine. You guys just keep making it more efficient. And I was talking today with one of your competitors and asked them if they were going to bring out a diesel version of a particular car. And they said they were going to, but their new gas engine gets only 1 mile per gallon less than the diesel was going to get. So why, you know, how do you make the case if you continue to advance the gas engine like that?
Can I make a case for just a new Toyota? But I think it's reflective in the whole industry. You mentioned earlier we're just launching our new Corolla. But when you take a look at that Corolla, it's a subcompact vehicle. Now, it's a different Corolla than sold globally. We lengthened the wheelbase and increased the track to give it the capacity. But when you look at that Corolla, the interior packaging in the subcompact is actually as good marginally better by a couple of millimeters than our mid-size sedans were three generations ago. The MPG, you can get it with an optional eco engine, which has a sophisticated valve train on it, 42 MPG. 15 years ago, or 12 years ago, when we launched the new Prius, the first generation Prius, the first generation Prius was rated at 41 miles per gallon.
Yep.
So today, to your point, is, you know, we have ICEs that are bigger than midsize, getting better fuel mileage than the first generation hybrids. And I think that's
very telling. Right.
It's the transformation the entire industry is going through.
It is, but none of that comes for free. I mean, you know, it's not like you just figured out a bunch of stuff. There's a lot of technology that comes at a cost that's being put on those cars.
Well, that's why I came up with the Hydrogen Electric Racing Federation. At one point, there was a narrow window where the manufacturers, including Toyota, were very interested. GM was very interested. Those were the two.
And, of course, you wanted to do it. Use racing to solve all the technical issues.
Yeah, GM was big on it. I mean, Bob Lutz spoke at the introduction of it. I had all the major racing players there, and the idea was to race these cars to solve the problems. What are the problems on hydrogen cars? Storage, delivery, heat, weight. All those things. And so the idea of the Hydrogen Electric Racing Federation is we would do a series of races in conjunction with the Indy 500 to have those vehicles and just keep doing it until they got better. Because when you get racers involved, what happens?
Yeah, problems get solved.
Problems get solved. I mean, we envisioned storage tanks getting smaller. I mean, everything getting lighter. All those things. But of course, then that was in January 2007, and then things started to go bad, and then GM decided they weren't interested. But I got a nice letter from one of the top technical guys at Toyota saying they were very interested, and let us know when someone else does it first.
Yeah. Well, isn't that part of the reason why you guys are making this announcement that you are going to bring one to market, is that if you don't, you know, if no one does, we're never going to get there.
Right. And it's a little bit of the classic, you know, chicken or egg. You need the hydrogen, but you need the product. So somebody's got to do the investment. So we're out early and been talking about it. Granted, it will take a long time to develop this, but it's got to start somewhere. It feels many ways, you know, in 1999, I was with Toyota at the time, but, you know, when I first heard about this, you know, what do you mean it has both a gasoline and electric motor? And, you know, look where we are today. It's got to start somewhere. But there's got to be the confidence to invest in that infrastructure.
Well, one of the things I thought was interesting that some of your people talked about last week was, just like with that Gen 1 Prius, where you guys were prepared to lose money on each one in order to create a market for the vehicle, you said, we're prepared to do that with hydrogen, too, to get this going.
Yeah. You know, and it's an investment in the future. You know, the Prius is, you know, an icon in the industry now, but it took us to the second generation before we had a viable business model from it. But, you know, that's the challenge. And I think, you know, bringing any new technology, it takes a while to get it scaled up.
Well, that's one thing. I think the Japanese companies in particular taught Detroit. They were very interested in the long view, whereas traditional Detroit way back when was by the quarter.
Yeah.
And usually by the sales reports, which were at one point 10-day sales
reports. Every
10 days,
that's right.
And that's one thing the Japanese auto industry, that was an important lesson for Detroit, because, like, you have to take the long view. Toyota took the long view when they introduced the Lexus. I mean, you were nowhere. And you were willing to take a hit on each one sold to establish the name in the market. That's something Detroit was not really, you know, thrilled to do. But, you know, they've learned. But you guys still set the benchmark for that. I mean, that takes a lot of guts. So whether it repeats itself with the hydrogen car, we don't know. But do I believe hydrogen is probably the future? I think it's a piece of it, like we've said. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think our transportation is going to be a kaleidoscope of stuff. I mean, the ICE is going to be around for another 30, 40, 50 years. I don't know.
Peter, I agree, and you just summed up, you know, sort of our position. It will definitely be a piece of the industry. Now, we can argue how big of a piece. My own personal feeling is it's an interesting car. You know, today, it's got to start somewhere. But really, we're probably looking not at our children, but our grandchildren. You know, it has the potential.
Yeah.
And you know, we want to be there.
Hey, with that, why don't we take a quick commercial break and come back for the rapid-fire part of the show where we get into the questions from the audience. So, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Hyundai.
What's my type? Well, they have to be smart, a good sense of direction, good taste in music, and, of course, good looks with nice curves. That gets my temperature rising every time we touch. And that exotic name, Elantra. Wait, are we talking about cars?
Okay, this is the rapid-fire part of the show, and Ben, we got to let your graphic rip there. Okay, first question comes in from Pedro Fernandez, who says, ask Mr. Carter if Toyota is planning to do anything else in the States with the FRS chassis, which is really helping Scion out these days. He asks, perhaps a rear-wheel drive four-door sports sedan like the old 2002 or the 318i of yore?
Best driving car for $25,000 in the market, and we would absolutely love to. We're studying a number of different issues, but nothing I can confirm or announce tonight.
Oh, darn it. Okay. Rum and Coke wants to know, why is the FRS branded as a Scion? Wouldn't it work well as a Celica?
Well, in some markets, it's actually sold as the Toyota FT86, which is an iconic name. We really have a very interesting youth strategy with Scion. FRS is the icon of it right now, so it fits very well within that brand, and it's really streamlined the purchase process for a lot of the consumers. So we think it's the right approach for the U.S.
Well, it's the only thing you have in Scion right now that's really doing well, too. I mean, frankly.
Yeah, Scion. Stay tuned for Scion. The some of the models we have, the XB and XD, are getting very late in its life cycle. So. FRS is leading the way right now.
Bob, you've got Lexus as part of everything that you oversee, too. What do you make of this concept vehicle that Lexus is going to show at the Frankfurt Auto Show? Ben, do you got a picture of that you can pull up? This thing's, wow. you said what, angry with the Corolla? What was the
fierce.
Fierce.
This is
This is fierce.
Yeah, that's a great vehicle that we're going to show at Frankfurt next week. But it's an exercise in when you look at Lexus and came out with the RX 300 back in 1999, it was the first unibody crossover luxury vehicle in the market, and it's done exceptionally well. It really created a category. This is an exercise of what if it was a little smaller.
Just an exercise.
At this moment.
Okay, and then there's another one that Toyota's showing, this Yaris Hybrid R. Ben, let's get a picture. Do you have that Yaris? Now, it looks to me like you're trying, and this is a hybrid.
It is.
And it's a high-performance hybrid.
Yes.
I mean, quite high-performance hybrid.
Yes.
So what's the thinking behind this?
Well, it's, these small, high-performance, high-end hatchbacks are very popular in Europe. So undetermined, you know, if there's a real market for this, high-performance B-segment car in the U.S., but interested in pursuing it, testing the waters for potential future European entry.
Is this a move, too, to change the image of the hybrid, you know, which has got a, you know, very nice environmental, warm and fuzzy, and say, no, you can You can haul ass if you want.
I will tell you that that's going to be the future of hybrid. Our brands sort of went down two different paths. Toyota went environmental hybrid. It's all about MPG. And then Lexus, the first iterations of hybrid were really performance. You know, take a six-cylinder and give it better than V8 performance. Where you'll see Toyota going in the future is bringing in more emotional design, more intriguing design, but we also want to bring in more fun-to-drive characteristics, to drive the handling. That's driven from the top down, from Akio Toyota, the number one car guy within our company. And so you'll stay tuned. You'll see a significant change in direction. Cars similar to what they're going to be shown in Frankfurt next month.
Let's see. Looks like we've got a phone call here. Ben, you want to bring in this phone call that's come in from Cleveland?
Hi, guys. This is Youngblood calling Cleveland, Ohio. I have a question for Mr. Carter. Would you comment on the possibility of the new Cummins V8 diesel? I think that's a 5-liter diesel being considered for the Tundra or one of the larger Toyota pickup trucks.
Yeah. Good question. Nissan just announced.
Bye.
Oh, thanks. Nissan announced it's going to put the Cummins diesel in the Titan pickup.
Yeah, they did, and we actually have that under very deep study. I don't think it's a great surprise. We actually created some prototypes. We're trying to get a little bit of understanding of where diesel in the heavy duty market is from a regulation standpoint when you get out to the end of this decade. So. No decisions made at this time. Nothing's green lighted, but that's an area of the business that we continue to be very interested in.
What do you make of these moves to propane and natural gas in commercial trucks? Has that caught your attention at Toyota?
Improved MPG is something not only Toyota but the entire industry needs to pursue with the regulations. So it goes back to that portfolio approach. We're looking at all of it, and even though that we decided as two companies to stop the co-development of hybrid for pickup trucks, we had the agreement with Ford, we're still very much interested in pursuing that, a hybrid application for heavy-duty usage. So there's still a lot of things on the table.
Dr. Nick wants to know if gas prices spike. Maybe I don't ask this to you, Bob, but to my other guys here. You know, gas prices have been going up. What happens to the Detroit 3? Dr. Nick wants to know, can they survive as car companies, not just truck companies?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at Ford, I mean, with their EcoBoost engines and stuff, I think they're well positioned to deal with. If anything, they've bet too heavily, wouldn't you say, Peter, on you know, fuel economy with, you know, the Fiesta kind of.
Well, they certainly are changing the small car landscape in this country, and I think GM is better equipped too. Mm-hmm. Fiat Chrysler, I don't know. They can't make enough 500s in the or Darts, so I don't know. I don't know.
There's always going to be a market for pickups, though, too. Just from the commercial sector, if nowhere else.
You know, if gas spikes, I mean, sure, truck sales always take a dive. Those two companies we talked about are better positioned, but, you know, people are still going to buy trucks. They just won't buy them in the volumes there, you know.
If I can add to that, that's right. You can't be a general contractor and, you know, have a Prius for that usage. But what we find is fuel prices are concerned, but what affects the industry more than just the raw price, it's the rate of change. If there's a slow migration to $4 a gallon, nobody likes it. But that's one scenario. But if it rapidly is, you know, you go to bed and it's $3.50 and you wake up in the morning and it's $4, that rate of change is what shocks the industry and is problematic. So, you know, if it's going up, but it's going up moderately and gradually. That's much healthier situation.
When was the first time that spike? Was that June of 2008, May of 2008 when it
No, Katrina was the
right.
Yeah.
Katrina, but then there was another one the summer.
But all throughout 2008,
yeah.
Prices really went
and
up that, very
that's
quickly.
That's when people started. To
well,
get...
that's my story. I remember in 2008 going down to the Tigers baseball game, and everyone's going 55 miles an hour. 2 years later, it's $4 a gallon, and everyone's going 80.
Yeah,
confidence.
It's, right? And the slow increase.
But that, you know, you mentioned May. I think you were right, May of 2008. And just automatically, I mean, just overnight, it seemed like...
It went up a dollar.
It went up a dollar. And V8 sales, pickup truck sales, SUV sales just stopped. And then we were in a situation we couldn't build Priuses enough. But it's that sudden change is what affects the market.
Mm-hmm. Jim wrote in to say, I hear that Toyota's pulling out of NASCAR. Is that true?
Absolutely not. I don't know if I'm the number one NASCAR fan, but I'm very close to it. So we got a great two teams in Joe Gibbs and Michael Waltrip. It's going to be a big race this weekend in Richmond.
Huge.
But I got my fingers crossed. We know we have three Toyotas in the chase. And we have a chance to get Martin Truex, the fourth one, in. But
and this is the last race before the chase, right? So
it's part of who we are. We're there for the long term.
Let's see if I can read this one right. Abhi from Halifax, Canada says, why did Lexus change its platform from Camry to Avalon? People's perception will still be the same that a Lexus ES model is based on a Camry. So why make the change now instead of years ago?
Well, you know, there are shared platform componentry throughout the industry, and she's correct. There you know, the Avalon, the Camry, the ES, there are, you know, there are similar platform characteristics. But the platforms are modified. They're strengthened or they're lengthened, so the cars have completely different characteristics themselves. But, you know, that's not unusual in the industry to share platforms across brands.
No, very, very common. I like that new Avalon, too, by the way.
That's a phenomenal car.
We had the chief engineer.
Chief engineer was here, Randy Stevenson. So that was a great show.
Randy's a very good friend right down the street. We have a number of our chief engineers, and we just made an announcement today that we're expanding TTC.
Your engineering campus just outside Ann Arbor.
Yes, thank you. So we're putting another investment in there to expand that and bringing more engineers in to specifically work on powertrain development. So that's our extremely important engineering center here for us in close by in Ann Arbor.
Yeah. I think this is really an amazing thing. I had an opportunity a few weeks ago to sit down with all four of the chief engineers out there. I mean, four Americans, four Michiganders, you know, with full responsibility for five major products for Toyota globally. And I think that's really a testament to how much your company has changed over the past few years.
Yeah. Well, that's one aspect of it. But the company's really changed because when you think just what, 3 years ago, you guys were really getting bashed for all this so-called unintended acceleration, you know, horrific accidents, you know, captured on TV, all kinds of lawsuits, quality problems. And here you are sitting, you know, just coming off August sales in 2013. And you guys got things straightened out pretty good, it seems.
Yeah, that was a tough, difficult time for the company. And we did change the company of a lot of our processes. With regard to the UA allegations, the unattended acceleration, there was nothing there. I mean, there was speculation out there that there was ghosts in the electronics. Okay. We built 40 million cars with electronic throttle controls, and I can tell you not one incidence of unattended acceleration.
No, that was a scam argument, and that's where they had to, you know, short out the controller to, it was a scam.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting that we're perfect by any means, but that was...
Look, the whole unintended acceleration thing has been around forever. It damn near killed Audi. If Audi had not been part of the Volkswagen group, it would have abandoned the American market. Others have run into it. In fact, the whole incidence of, reported incidents of unintended acceleration predate electronic throttle control. It's not a new issue. Right. So it's just that every now and then something hits the headlines because he had this ex-cop, right, who got killed in, what was it, a Prius?
No, it was in San Diego, and it was a Lexus.
And that made that made international news.
Right, and it was a very unfortunate situation.
Terrible situation.
But that was the pedal was trapped through a poor-fitting floor mat.
Right. But after that, that brought out everybody out of the woodwork saying, oh, my Toyota's accelerating out of control.
Right. But the good was we really did take and reevaluate all of our processes and all of our how we operate here in North America. And we're a better company today, not because of the allegations, but we had a lot of self-reflection. The major investment that we have here in 1,400 engineers just down the street, you know, we accelerated our activities because of
it's doing hardcore engineering here, not just importing stuff, not just assembling things that were designed in Japan. It's the fact that, you know, as Bryce did on that story, and I saw your story too, it was really interesting, of these chief engineers located here. No, I think it's awesome. I think Toyota's a terrific corporate citizen and a part of the American auto industry from that standpoint. So, kudos to you guys. You brought Mark Hogan in, who used to be at GM on the Toyota board. So it's impressive to me to see how Toyota went after all these changes.
Yeah, you got two members of Toyota's board of directors living in Michigan right now.
Is that right?
Yeah, because Nagata-san, the head of manufacturing engineering, is in Novi now.
Yeah.
And Hogan. I mean, who would have thought that 10 years ago?
Never.
Yeah.
Never.
Someone at Toyota told me that when they opened the Kyushu or one of the first factory outside Nagoya was like a major, cathartic moment in the history of the company to have a factory that wasn't in Toyota City. And now here you guys are, shifting all this responsibility to the U.S.
Well, our largest manufacturing plant worldwide, globally. By far, the largest one, Georgetown, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Many people are surprised when they hear that. Really, it's not the heart of Japan. And that's, last year, over 500,000 units produced there. And it's one of the changes you're seeing in the company. A lot of these products that are being designed here in Ann Arbor and built in our 14 manufacturing plants that we have in the U.S. are now being exported. And actually, this year, we're exporting vehicles that are built here to 23 different countries. Now, it's a still small part of our business, about 100,000 units. But that's one of the areas that we know we can grow.
That's cool to hear. Hey, we've got another call in. We'll probably make this the last question. But, Ben, let's bring that in.
Hey, guys. Andrew Jackson from Grand Rapids, Michigan here. Just a question. You were talking about Toyota and Lexus, that the company was willing to lose money at first on things like the whole launch of Lexus or the Prius in order to build the brand image. How far out are you willing to lose money on something before getting a verdict on whether it's a success or not so much? Thanks.
Okay. Good question.
A very tough question. I mean, lose money investing in the future, perhaps different definitions. But, Toyota is very fortunate that we invest, their average R&D spend is still about $1 million an hour, $365 a year on globally. So we're investing in all new technologies. But sometimes when the technology is ready for prime time, such as we think that fuel cell is there and back in 1997, you put that out, you don't have an expectation that you're going to recover all your costs in a generation. But if you're convinced that this can be a viable product and then fit the needs of the customer in the future, it may take time over several generations to recover that initial investment. But I think, that's part of the industry. It's got to start somewhere.
It worked with hybrids for you guys. It's become an important and profitable part of your business.
Yeah. And that's I think that's a fascinating thing about the auto industry. If we were to sit around and say, what is the game changers of the car business? Well, to me, certainly you'd have to put a Prius in that. That changed the industry. A Dodge Caravan, to me, that changed the whole perception of the van markets. And there's some of those unique vehicles that really truly did change the industry and the history. But they started off slow, mm-hmm. and they all started off with doubters. RAV4, we introduced that first unibody SUV in the market. And I remember standing at the auto show and said, what are you guys thinking of? An SUV without a transfer case? Who's going to buy that? And there's many examples around, but it takes some time to to get them out there until the consumers accept them.
Hey, Ben, am I reading this right? Is there another phoner or not?
No.
Okay, good enough. With that, we're going to wrap it up. But Bob Carter, thanks so much for coming on Autoline After Hours. This has been great having you here.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, Bob.
Peter, Bryce. Yeah. Thank you.
Bryce, good seeing you.
Hey, always a pleasure, Bryce. John.
Good cool. to see
thank you.
You,
gentlemen.
Peter, great having you.
John.
As always. I want to thank all of you for having tuned in. Remember, the podcast will be at the iTunes Store tomorrow. Also, on Tuesday, we're going to be webcasting from the Frankfurt Auto Show. Starts at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and you can watch it all at www.autoline.tv. But for now, thanks for having tuned in to Autoline After Hours.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by the 2013 Hyundai Elantra. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
Visit our website, Autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at Autoline.tv.